In the wake of Pearl Harbor, the U.S. government incarcerated 110,000 Japanese Americans in internment camps. A piece of history from this difficult time has been sitting near Shell, Wyoming, for decades. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. One of the original barracks from the Heart Mountain Relocation Center in northern Wyoming has been located at the Iowa State University Geology Field Study Station. Now, the Interpretive Center at Heart Mountain is hoping to get the building back. We'll find out more about this unlikely story. Then, later on in the hour, I'll talk with Stephen Lyons about his new book, Going Driftless. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, Stephen J. Lyons, author of the new book Going Driftless, will be here. He spent time traveling around the driftless area in Wisconsin, Illinois, Iowa, and Minnesota, and he's written about his experiences and the people he met there. But first, we're going to talk about an unusual historic artifact that has been sitting for decades near Shell, Iowa. It's one of the original barracks from the Heart Mountain Relocation Center in northern Wyoming. And it's been located at the Iowa State University Geology Field Studies Station. Now, the Interpretive Center at Heart Mountain is hoping to get the building back. And we'll find out more about how this barrack building made its way to Iowa, but we're going to start with some important history. In the wake of Pearl Harbor, the U.S. government incarcerated 110,000 Japanese Americans in internment camps. Neil Nakadate's family was among those interred at the camps. He is the grandson of immigrants from Japan. And about a year ago, he published his memoir, Looking After Minidoka. He's also an emeritus professor of English at Iowa State University. Hello, Neil.
Good morning.
Welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Brian Leisinger is also here. He's executive director of the Heart Mountain Interpretive Center. Hello, Brian.
Hello, good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today. And a lot of us are not familiar with the Heart Mountain Relocation Center. So can you fill us in a little bit and tell us about this particular camp?
Yeah, and if I may, can I make one clarifying statement about the barrack itself is actually in Shell, Wyoming.
Oh.
So we don't have to come all the way to Iowa to get it.
I'm sorry. Yeah, my mistake. Sorry about that. Go on. Please tell us about Heart Mountain.
So Heart Mountain was one of the 10 confinement camps that was created in the wake of Pearl Harbor to confine the Japanese Americans from the West Coast, those who were considered a threat to our nation at the time. And Heart Mountain itself housed between 10,000 and 11,000 people at any given time, making it essentially the third largest city, if you would call it that, in Wyoming. It was comprised of over 700 buildings. It was open for more than 3 years. And one of the reasons now that we have this opportunity with the barrack is that when it did close, the government tried to clear the land as quickly as possible and sold off the barracks cheaply, typically for a dollar, to homesteaders and veterans who then moved them to their homesteads and so forth.
All right, and we'll talk about where the barracks that wound up at the geological station for Iowa State University went and how they wound up there later on. But can you also give me an idea of how many camps there were like Heart Mountain?
Yeah, there were 10, and they were typically in very desolate locations across the country. Minidoka, like you mentioned, is in a very similar landscape that Heart Mountain is, about 8 hours drive west of here. Most of these places, you know, sagebrush, prairie, not typically a city for miles around. So there was a camp in Minidoka. There was also one in Colorado called Granada. There were two in California. There were two in Arizona. And there were two as far east as Arkansas.
And Neil, to get the personal perspective on how these camps operated and what happened after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, when we spoke to you on this program a little over a year ago, we talked a lot about your family's history. So we'll just sort of, in a nutshell, say that your grandparents came from Japan, but your parents were born in the United States, in Oregon. When the war broke out, your mother was living with her family in Oregon. What happened to them?
Well, they were first moved to an assembly center in Portland, which was the first confinement that they had. And then they were there until the camp in Idaho had been constructed. And then they were sent out to Idaho on a train and ended up there for the remainder, you know, for the duration of the war.
Your father was a physician, and he was not sent to one of these camps. And a very interesting story. Basically, it sounded like that was on the basis of him being an Eagle Scout in the Boy Scouts, that he had a reputation that
he was. What happened was that he was in the midst of a medical residency, and he was in Detroit at the time. And one of the reasons he was not one of the people who was rounded up, even though he was in the Midwest, was the fact that by a wonderful coincidence, the FBI learned that he had been an Eagle Scout in Portland, Oregon, with one of the FBI agents in the Detroit office. And so he basically was given clearance on the basis of that prior association with the Boy Scout who grew up to be an FBI agent.
Your mother then got a special dispensation to go and marry your father. So she had an opportunity to leave the camp, but she ended up going back. What happened?
There were some problems that my grandparents were having because it turned out that they were ended up being the caregivers for my two cousins, who are a few years older than I am, but at the time were 3, 4, 5, 6 years old. And so they wrote to my mother and asked if she could return to the camp, at least for a while, and help them stabilize the family situation. And so my mother did, in fact, go back. And by then, my parents had been married. By then, I had been born. So my mother ended up taking me with her to Idaho. And I was actually there for 6 months, although I was so little at the time, I don't remember anything of it personally.
So many lives were disrupted by this internment. And your aunt's story is so heartbreaking because she lost so much through this experience. Can you tell us a little bit about her?
She, by a coincidence, when the war started, she was diagnosed with tuberculosis. So she was sent to a TB hospital in Portland, where they were living, of course, at the time. And so she was married and had two little children. And then the war started, and the family was removed from Portland, and she couldn't go with them because she had a communicable disease. And so it turned out that she didn't see those children for over 2.5 years. And it was very difficult for her, very difficult for my cousins to be there in the camp without their mother. And their father ended up basically abandoning them. And so it was just my cousins and my grandparents until my mother and I showed up to kind of help out a little.
What were living conditions like in the camp for your grandparents and your cousins?
The hardest part about living in a camp was that there was no real domestic space so that families could have the kind of family interaction that they had had in their hometowns. So they were in basically a barracks-like situation without the capacity to do their own cooking and do their own, you know, their housekeeping and so on and so forth in their own unit. And so everything from the laundry to the bathrooms to the mess hall was outside the family unit. And that made it very difficult, not just because of the daily multiple times the inconvenience, but it was particularly difficult, as Brian has suggested, to have to do that in the winter. In the middle of a Idaho winter or a Wyoming winter, that was very, very difficult to do, especially with children.
Your grandparents came to the United States looking for opportunity, and had built lives here. What happened to all of their belongings, all of the things that they had built over the years when they were taken to this camp?
Well, they lost virtually all of their investment that they had built up in the United States, because the money they had saved virtually all of it was lost in the course of the internment. And so when the internment ended, when the incarceration was over, they returned to Portland, but they didn't have a place to live. They didn't have jobs and so on. And getting for my grandparents who were in their 50s and 60, my grandfather was over 60, my grandmother was over 50. They were basically starting over in America at that point. Of course, they were too old really to be able to gain any economic traction at that time.
You were only at the camp for 6 months. You can't remember that time in your life. Was this something that your parents talked to you about, that your grandparents talked to you about as you were growing up to make sure you understood what had happened?
I was many, by that I mean thousands of Japanese-American families that didn't really discuss the camp experience at any length with their children. And so a lot of us grew up knowing that there had been a thing called camp, but not really knowing much about the actual experience, except in little comments that we overheard, or that, you know, where people slipped up and said something that made it clear that it had been extremely difficult for them. And so a lot of what I know about it, I had to kind of get it out of people later on through interviews and dinner table conversations and so on. But that was later.
Why do you think they didn't want you to know?
My mother told me outright. She said it was too painful. The whole experience was too painful to be able to talk about. And so it wasn't until literally 30 years later, which is a generation later, my children were born by that time, that she was able to talk about it. And she said, well, maybe I can start talking about it now, but it's been too painful up until now.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Neil Nakadati. He's written his memoir. It's called Looking After Minidoka, about his family's experience in one of these Japanese internment camps in the United States after Pearl Harbor. He's also an emeritus professor of English at Iowa State University. Brian Leisinger is here, executive director of the Heart Mountain Interpretive Center. And coming up in a few minutes, we'll also talk with Carl Vondra, professor emeritus of geology at Iowa State University. And we'll get the story on how this barrack came to be at Iowa State University's Geology Field Study Center and how it may make its way back to Heart Mountain. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in a few minutes, I'll be talking to Stephen Lyons. He's the author of the new book, Going Driftless, about the driftless area in Wisconsin, Illinois, Iowa, and Minnesota, and the people who live there. But right now, we're talking about some unusual history. There's an original barrack from the Heart Mountain Relocation Center in northern Wyoming. It's been located at the Iowa State University Geology Field Studies Station for decades now. And the Interpretive Center at Heart Mountain is hoping to get the building back. Right now, there's a fundraising process going on to get enough money to move this building back, this original barrack, back to the place it came from. With me this hour, Neil Nakadati. His family was among those interred at the Japanese-American internment camps after Pearl Harbor. He is the grandson of immigrants from Japan. He has written a memoir called Looking After Minidoka. He's also an emeritus professor of English at Iowa State University. Brian Leisinger is here, executive director of the Heart Mountain Interpretive Center. And Brian, we've been listening to a short version of Neil's family's story. Is there anything, you do a lot of educating about this time in American history. Is there anything else that you feel like people should know about this time that we haven't covered?
Yeah, I mean, the basic narrative, I think, and what we put people through when we take them to our museum is to hopefully get them to walk a few steps in the incarceree's shoes. And what that means is emphasizing that because of these people's heritage, they were forcibly removed from their homes. As Neil mentioned, the painful experience of having the life you had built up basically erased. You know, they weren't told where they were going, how long they'd be there, and they were imprisoned without being charged with a crime. And what that meant then for those who ended up at Heart Mountain was a 3 to 4 day train ride where they arrived to their new home, which was this barrack apartment. And when they stepped into their barrack apartment, they saw a pot-bellied stove, a light bulb, a few bed frames and mattresses, and that was it. And that's what they were left with to try to endure this next chapter of their lives. And so we try to, at our interpretive center, give visitors a powerful experience of what that was like, but then also how they endured and sort of stoically persevered through that experience, how they built community in camp, which is a layer upon layer of tremendous stories about how they endured this experience.
And you don't have any of the original barracks at the Interpretive Center right now.
We do not. We have a few buildings remaining from the hospital complex, which was 17 buildings at one time. We have 3 of those remaining buildings. We have acquired an original root cellar that we're restoring, and we have the original honor roll memorial, which features the names of those who served in World War II. But we do not have a barrack. There were more than 450 of them here, and we do not have a barrack.
All right, although hopefully that will be remedied by the end of the summer. I want to bring Carl Vondra into the conversation. He's professor emeritus of geology at Iowa State University. Hello, Carl.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
I'm pleased to be here.
And can you give us a little bit of history about how this barrack building and 2 others, there were actually 3, wound up at the Iowa State University geology field camp?
Yes, I can. We established a field station in 1957. We actually purchased the property at that time, which was about 8 acres, 2 miles east of Shell and 2 miles west of the mountains, the Bighorn Mountains. It's a beautiful area, beautiful setting. We had no buildings, but we were able to obtain buildings from the city of Grable or the town of Grable. They had 3 of the buildings that they used as a community center and for various organizations that met in the buildings. They were no longer in use. This was 1958, and they were willing to lease them to us. They leased them to us at the rate of $1 per year, and I don't believe we ever paid any of the lease fees. But we had a good agreement with them, and we had the lease for 25 years, and then again it was renewed after 25 years. And then most recently they decided they didn't want the buildings back when we no longer could use them. It was Chalmer Roy, who was chair of the department at that time, and Professor Keith Hussey, who established the camp and were able to negotiate with the town of Grable to get the buildings. 2 buildings arrived in 1958, and then a 3rd building we were able to obtain in 1965. And that's the building that we're happy to give to the Interpretive Center and glad that they can use it. We actually offered all 3 buildings to the Interpretive Center, but the previous director of the Interpretive Center decided he didn't want them. But Mr. Leisinger, of course, knowing that they didn't have one, was happy to get it, and now the problem is to move it there.
Right.
And it'll be very expensive.
So these buildings were appealing to the university because they were very inexpensive, but when these buildings were built, they weren't really works of craftsmen. They weren't built to last a long time. What are they like?
Oh, they were very poorly constructed. The building that we're giving to the Interpretive Center is about 120 feet long and 20 feet wide, and it was divided into I believe, 6 apartments. The construction was very bad. There was no insulation. The buildings were covered with tar paper and tar paper roof. So in the summer, they were very hot with the black tar paper roof. And in the winter, not being insulated, they were very cold. And there were so many mistakes made in the construction. The people that constructed these buildings had no experience as carpenters. They were just people that were cowboys and various other people that were brought in to construct these as rapidly as possible with no experience. One of the problems, for example, was the flooring for the building was actually placed down on top of floor joists, and the subfloor was placed on top of the flooring because the people that didn't realize there was a difference between the two. So there were serious mistakes that were made in the construction, and they were very poorly constructed and obviously didn't last long.
Well, except that they did last quite a long time at the field station, and students lived in these buildings. You must have lived in these buildings at various times, right?
Yeah, well, they lasted for us because we put a lot of our work into it. We covered the walls with paneling, and then we covered the exterior with exterior plywood, and we painted the buildings. We did insulate them as well. So for us, the 6 weeks or 8 weeks that we were out at the field station, they did provide a very important function. So we got a lot of use out of them. They were very primitive. They did not have internal plumbing. So we had outhouses that we had to use. We had to dig an outhouse every so often. We had no water in the buildings. So we had to build a shower house. So we had a separate shower house. We were able to, in one of the buildings, put in a kitchen. And we were able to plumb that so that we could run water into the kitchen. And we had a mess hall in one of the buildings. So a kitchen and mess hall in one of the buildings. The other two buildings were used to house the students.
And we actually have an email from someone who once was one of your students. This is from Donald Brown in Los Angeles. He says, I was privileged to spend 2 summers in Iowa State's Japanese American Relocation Camp Barracks in Shell, Wyoming. The barracks were central to the students' existence at camp. We slept in them, we studied in them, we ate in them, and we made lifelong friendships in them. It's hard for me to somehow separate the history of the barracks and their previous life at the Heart Mountain Relocation Camp from the barracks that I used at geology camp. In thinking back on Dr. Vondra's teaching, what I remember most is that he made no effort to dilute the complex and demanding academic problems that we faced at camp. But back to the barracks, after a demanding 10-hour day in the field learning geology, we always knew that we had a soft mattress, clean sheets, a hot shower, and plenty of hot food awaiting us. But in contrast to the experiences of the Japanese Americans interned at Heart Mountain, the renovated Japanese American Relocation Camp barracks at Iowa State University's geology field camp were to us, in every wonderful, every memorable, and every immeasurable sense of the word, home. A nice letter from one of your students. It also does invite some questions. I mean, Brian, the former director of the Interpretive Center at Heart Mountain, didn't want the barracks because he was concerned that they had been changed too much. Why did you decide that you did want one of these buildings?
Well, and to sort of clarify that point, think of the time when that building was offered to our foundation. It was a very difficult decision because we, you know, our museum opened in 2011. So a lot of time, money, effort was going into making sure that the museum was done well. And it was done well, and I don't think we were really in a position to handle such a large undertaking. And now it's a few years down the road. I had an opportunity to visit the barrack last year. Dr. Vondra's history is very good. I'm grateful for the upkeep that Iowa State did, but also that they didn't make major modifications, at least to the building we're seeking, because there's no, you know, there's no kitchen, there's no plumbing, as he stated. It's been cared for, but it hasn't been really modified. One room in particular has very minimally modified. You can see the skeleton of the building. You can see all the wood slats. It's a very powerful piece for us. And so it's just we're just grateful that they're allowing us this opportunity.
Now, what will the process of moving it be like? How big an obstacle is this?
Well, there are construction obstacles, and then there are obstacles in the way to getting it out of the lane there. But this barrack is situated in a good spot for getting it out of where it is through a neighboring farmer's field. It was moved twice, so it's going to have some cracks in it. It's going to have some weak points, and so we'll have to stabilize those. We'll have to structurally stabilize it for the move. And it was cut into three pieces when it was moved previously, so we'll have to sort of honor those original cuts and move it in three pieces back to the site. So what it adds up to is a little bit painstaking and a little bit more costly than if we could move it in one chunk, but worth it for us, absolutely worth it.
What do you hope to do with it when you get it moved?
Well, we'll put it on, like you said, these were not meant to endure. We're going to do our best to make sure that it does endure, because it will be an incredibly powerful artifact of camp life and teaching people what life was like at Heart Mountain. So we'll put it on a permanent foundation, trying to honor as much historical accuracy as we can as we do that. And we'll, again, stabilize it from the inside, make sure that it's safe, make sure that it's up to code so that visitors can go in it. And at least for that one room, I know now that we'll do our best to restore it as it would have looked when the incarcerees walked in that first day in camp. The rest, we'll have to review. We'll have many conversations with our board, with former incarcerees who also serve on our board and who are our constant friends and consultants, to make sure that we're doing justice to their experience and that we're making the most of this really important feature for the evolution of our site.
Neil, I know that you've been involved with pilgrimages back to Minidoka. Going on that journey with other people who experienced life in an internment camp, what is left there? What can you see?
Well, it's interesting. I was on the pilgrimage last summer to Minidoka, and their experience has been similar to the one that Brian has described. They've been able to recover one of the barracks buildings that had been used by someone fairly close to the original site. It had become a storage shed, I believe, and they were able to recover that building, and they're searching for at least one other one that they're aware of, and so they're undergoing the same process of trying to recover artifacts that can give visitors a sense of the experience that people had in the 1940s. But again, as Brian said, everything is much more fragile than it was to begin with, and to begin with, the construction was not ideal anyway. I think it's really important to have examples of the structures that were there in the camps, because without artifacts, we lack a certain kind of evidence that can be part of our collective memory. And I guess it's what we call history, right? And it gives us a certain way to understand, a particular way to understand what happened. Things that happened so long ago are hard to understand sometimes without something tactile to trigger our understanding. So I think it's really, for me, it was very important to be able to walk inside one of those barracks buildings and feel what it must have been like at the time.
And what did that feel like to you?
It felt, well, it as Brian has described and Carl has described, these buildings were very minimalist and very bare. So there's a real sense that there was barely anything between the people and the, I guess what we would call the landscape, the weather and so on. And you could see right away how your the well-being of an incarceree would be affected by the time, by the seasons. Very hot in the summer, very cold in the winter, and not much way to deal with those changes.
Neil Nakadati, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Neil Nakadati has shared his family's experience in the United States and also at the Japanese internment camp Minidoka in his memoir, Looking After Minidoka. He's also an emeritus professor of English at Iowa State University. Brian, when do you think that this process will be complete?
Well, we've got till the end of the summer, roughly, but August. Our goal is August, hopefully the first part of August. We're in the midst of the fundraising process, which is going very well, but we've got a ways to go. And we've got to get our logistical people, our specialists in this sort of work, lined up and make sure that we're all on the same page. But August is our goal.
All right. Brian Leisinger, Executive Director of the Heart Mountain Interpretive Center in Wyoming. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
And Carl Vondra, Professor Emeritus of Geology at Iowa State University. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
We'll continue Talk of Iowa in a moment. We're going to travel to the Driftless area in Wisconsin, Iowa, Minnesota, and just a little bit of Illinois in just a few minutes with the author, Stephen Lyons, author of Going Driftless. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.